On his first day, President Trump shut down an app for people seeking asylum in the U.S. Migrants are now making new plans.
Ya no es el sueño americano, sino mexicano, hermano.
This man is reimagining his American dream. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, new policy under a new administration. And in the Mideast, making sense of raids in the West Bank during a ceasefire in Gaza.
Plus, a radio telescope in India can detect sound from distant galaxies.
We can pick up an FM station on Pluto if it was there, an airport radar on Proxima Centauri, which is the nearest star.
But a new railroad line on Earth could disrupt the signals.
And as sunlight returns to northern Norway, an excuse to make pastries.
We fill them with vanilla cream and a raspberry jam.
All that and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for being here today. We begin the show on this Tuesday in the occupied West Bank, where Israel is conducting raids against armed Palestinian groups in the city of Jenin.
And that's just as prisoners are being released as part of the ceasefire agreement that went into effect in Gaza over the weekend. Fatima Abdul Karim is a Palestinian journalist based in Ramallah, where she covers the West Bank. When we spoke, she told me about what the Israeli military is calling Operation Iron Wall.
The operation is expected to take over the entire district of Jenin, which includes its eastern and western villages, besides the refugee camp in Jenin. And nine have been killed, including one Palestinian security officer, and 35 have been injured, including children. Now, this comes after slightly over a month of a Palestinian Authority security campaign that has been launched and focused on the Jenin refugee camp, where it's been trying to cut off the militant groups and the chaos and the armament of the Jenin Brigade.
So what do you think the Israeli military hopes to accomplish with these ongoing raids of Jenin?
It's hard to see because while these operations are taking place, we cannot enter as journalists. The destruction is mostly of infrastructure, including already broken roads that have IEDs, explosive devices that were put in place under rubble by the Palestinian fighters in Jenin camp. And this was part of what the Palestinian Authority's security campaign was aiming at, which is to detonate these IEDs and remove them. So it's unclear what is the matter that the Israelis are trying to take into their hands at the moment.
As of yesterday, President Trump is now steering U.S. policy in the region. Do you think expectations for what's to come under this new administration might be playing a part in what's happening on the ground in the West Bank?
The last 2 days have seen a series of alarming attacks in villages around Qalqilia area in the north of the West Bank and on main junctions and bypass roads across the West Bank. These assaults have been very violent. They were marked by arson, by property destruction, physical violence. They even threw rocks and attacked Palestinians driving across those roads. In addition, there was a growing concern that the placement of iron gates and heightened security at checkpoints by the Israeli army around Palestinian cities and villages, not on main roads, but in between Palestinian cities and villages in the West Bank, has increased, I would say, Palestinians' fear and concern that the situation that we are coming into might be emboldened by the presence of Trump in the White House.
Shifting gears somewhat to Gaza, as part of the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas, Israel has released some 90 Palestinian prisoners. What do we know about those prisoners?
The 90 include 21 children and the rest are women. Most of them have been serving different sentences, but most of them have been under administrative detention, which means that they were not charged of any particular crimes or charges, and they were not put on trial. It is safe to assume that some of them might be fearful of being arrested again. Many of them have told us that they do not wish to speak to media because they were threatened by the Israeli army of and the Israeli prisons authority of making any press interviews or re-engaging in any public activities, even celebrations in their hometowns or in their homes were not allowed. So I would say that many of the prisoners told us that the threats this time didn't only mention that they would be rearrested themselves, but also their family members would be affected and arrested as well.
We should mention as well that Hamas has released three Israeli hostages. Fatima, as the implementation of the ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel continues, do you expect the IDF to continue targeting the West Bank, where we began our conversation, the West Bank, for raids?
People have been seeing things getting worse. And in the recent days, people have been expressing more and more their concern over a possible revenge or a vengeful acts by both settlers, in addition to the very aggressive military presence across the West Bank. So yes, Palestinians are generally scared because they have been facing movement restrictions and heightened tensions for over 15 months now. But the past recent days have been particularly alarming for Palestinians in the West Bank, which puts the whole area under a skeptical light, let's say, and a precarious condition.
Fatima Abdul Karim is a Palestinian journalist covering the West Bank. She's based in Ramallah.
Yesterday, within minutes of being sworn in, President Donald Trump quickly ended a program that helped migrants reach the U.S. legally. Over the last 2 years, a smartphone app called CBP One gave nearly a million people a way to enter the U.S. legally and seek asylum. The app has been permanently suspended. The World's TV's Isaiah takes us to Mexico City to hear what comes next for migrants who had been using the app.
Outside of a shelter in Mexico City, a group of migrants sitting in plastic chairs are discussing the latest news. They are talking about the end of CBP-1 appointment system, which became the main avenue to seek asylum in the U.S. under the Biden administration. They've been waiting in Mexico City for months, hoping to get an asylum appointment on the app. But now, that's not a possibility anymore. It's not the American dream anymore. It's the Mexican dream, says Marcos Carrillo from Venezuela. He's been working as a delivery driver for nearly a year while waiting for his appointment. Now he's decided to seek asylum in Mexico. It doesn't mean because we can't enter the U.S., we can't make money or be successful in Mexico, he says. But remaining in Mexico isn't a good option for many other migrants.
No, nada más para comer y para arriendo.
Manuel Peralta, who sells earbuds and speakers in the streets of downtown Mexico City, says people don't make that much money here. He earns about $500 a month, which he says is barely enough to pay for food and rent. I'm going back to Venezuela, he says.
Pero en Venezuela no pagamos arriendo.
At least I don't have to pay for rent there. But for Ernesto, a Colombian man who didn't want to share his full name, returning to his country is unthinkable. He's planning to reach the U.S. any way he can. Like going through the hole to the U.S., he says, referring to gaps in the border fence that separates Mexico and the U.S. There is no going back, he says. Ernesto is planning to hire a smuggler who can help him cross the border illegally. It costs $8,000, he says. Immigration experts say we might start seeing an increase in illegal border crossings in the upcoming months, now that President Trump has blocked legal pathways. Adam Isaacson is a border security expert with the Washington Office on Latin America. He says the big winners of this policy change are migrant smugglers, many times linked to Mexican cartels.
If you make something more illegal and you close off all avenues for people to get it, you raise the price that people who offer this service can charge, in this case, the service of being a migrant smuggler.
For people who still want to seek asylum in the U.S., other alternatives are to present themselves at the border and declare their intent to apply for asylum, or to be processed directly by immigration agents at border crossings. But it's not yet clear whether these options will be viable under the new administration. For The World, I'm Tibisay Sea, Mexico City.
The sun is returning to the far north. Polar night, which started in November, is ending above the Arctic Circle with the first sunrise of the year. And in northern Norway, people celebrate that with pastries known as solbolla, or sun buns. Jørn Olsen runs the bakery operation for a chain of cafes in Tromsø in northern Norway. Jørn, let's start with these pastries themselves. What do they look like? What do they taste like?
Oh, the sun buns are ordinary buns that we flavor with saffron, and we fill them with vanilla cream and a raspberry jam.
So saffron, I imagine, makes the dough a little bit yellow like the sun, and then the vanilla custard is the same?
Yeah, the saffron makes the bun a bit yellow, and a mix between raspberry jam and vanilla cream looks like the when the sun comes back.
Oh, interesting. So it's more sunrise colored than the sun at the height of its peak.
Yeah.
And are these made just one day a year? Or do you enjoy them all throughout this season?
No. It's just once a year. The 21st of January is the one day in the year we make these sun buns.
And that's because it has been declared Sunday there in Tromsø. What is that? Are there traditions that people partake in on this day?
It's a tradition all over the northern part of Norway. So when the different parts of Norway see the sun, then we are celebrating, because it's been a long time since we saw it last time.
And what do you do on Sunday besides eat these tasty buns?
If the weather allows it, we are outside going up in the mountains. And most likely you have to go a bit up to be able to see the sun. Because if you're down by the sea level, it's the big mountains are in the way many times. So often you have to get a bit up.
And I imagine that is not what you did today. You were probably very busy baking all of those buns. What was today like for you and your bakery?
No, today it's just providing all the cafes with enough buns. So everybody who wants one has the opportunity to get one.
Mm.
So it's been a busy day driving around, delivering and baking and... But it's fun. It's once a year.
Do you know how many you made?
I made 600-700 today.
And so this is to celebrate coming out of the polar night when the sun is not visible for many, many, many weeks. Can you describe what that's like there in Tromsø?
When we see the sun, it's you feel the energy is coming back and people are more outside. You can go skiing. It's the community is waking up. When you see the sun, you feel that the energy is starting to get back because you have been wandering around in the dark for many months, and it's like spring. Every kid in all the schools, often the schools, if the weather is really good, they give the kids the day off to go out and enjoy the sun and just be with their family outside.
Yeah. And everyone's on a sugar high because they've had their sun buns.
Yeah, but just one.
Just one.
Yeah. On this day, you can eat as many as you want. It's a day for a celebration.
Did you get to see the sun at all today?
No, I did not. The sun is just up for a short while, and I was in the bakery then.
I can imagine the excitement for kids and adults alike to see the sun again after many months. How many sun buns did you eat today?
I ate two.
Two. Respectable.
Yeah. That was I had one this morning and I had one for lunch. So it was an unhealthy lunch today and breakfast.
You get a pass on Sunday.
Yeah.
Jørn Olsen runs the bakery for a coffee shop chain in Tromsø, Norway.
Coming up, the U.S. is pulling out of the World Health Organization, what that means at home and abroad, just ahead. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. One of the many executive orders President Trump signed yesterday was to take the United States out of the World Health Organization. Trump cited what he called the organization's mishandling of the COVID-19 pandemic and the unfairly onerous payments the U.S. is required to make to the organization. The United States is the biggest contributor of funds to the WHO. Devi Sridhar is the co-author of the book Governing Global Health, Who Runs the World and Why. She says leaving the WHO is a big deal.
It would be pretty, I mean, this would probably be the most significant event for the WHO since its creation post-World War II. What you're likely to see, hopefully, is other countries in Europe, around the world, you know, the emerging economies, trying to step up to make sure that the agency can maintain the work that it does around global health security and health systems. And so, best case scenario, other countries will step up. But then in that case, it's the United States that loses because it loses the information sharing and being at the table when this kind of crucial information is being shared around other countries.
So just for folks who, you know, might not remember exactly all the things that the WHO does, can you give me a couple of examples of global health response that might be impacted by this and then what that also means for the U.S. not being able to get access to that information?
WHO was set up post-World War II to act as the director and coordinator of international health work. So think of an outbreak of Ebola in West Africa or Zika virus in Brazil. What the WHO does is go in, gets the information, works with the country to make sure we have as much information as possible, and then shares it around its member states, which is those governments which are signed up to the United Nations. And so it plays an essential role in terms of disease detection and response and technical guidance to governments of how do you actually do this.
I know, for example, that the WHO monitors viruses that are spreading and helps supply information so that the flu vaccine can be updated every year. Is that something that the U.S. would no longer have access to if it pulls out of the WHO?
If you're not willing to pay the dues, then you remove yourself from that. Of course, the U.S. could set it up on its own. They could say, well, actually, we're just going to set up our own chains of information. But it just actually is going to cost more. And it's kind of ironic that given we have a new statement around trying to cut costs, reduce inefficiencies, streamline, why would you be trying to duplicate what you already have an agency doing?
One of President Trump's reasons for pulling the U.S. out of the WHO is the imbalance between what the U.S. contributes financially versus what China contributes. Can you break that down for us?
Well, the WHO has two streams of funding. The first is called core contributions, which is what you have to pay to be part of the agency. That's based on a UN formula on your GDP, and that you just have to pay to be part of it. And all, including China and the United States, pay that. The second stream is voluntary contributions. And this is where the United States, Britain, Gates Foundation become very important. This is what they pledge year to year to say, hey, we want you to work on polio. We're going to give you money for it. Hey, we want you to work on malaria. And that's where the U.S. contributes a huge amount and China does not. So where I was a bit puzzled is why wouldn't the United States say, well, actually, we're just going to pull back to our core contributions, remain at the table, or we're not going to give you this extra money unless actually we see whatever changes he might want to see in the agency or other countries step up. There are ways that they could stay at the table, but actually negotiate a better deal for the United States and reasonably do ask other countries like China or Brazil or India to step up a bit more.
What is the timeline for this actually taking effect?
Well, you have to have congressional approval. And so it's unlikely to happen, you know, this week, but could it happen in the next few months? Definitely so. And where the WHO is trying to say, hey, what can we do to talk to you and negotiate what might keep you at the table? But at the same time, looking to other countries, especially across Europe, and saying, can you step up? So if they do, in fact, exit, we're not going to completely like fall through, that we actually have some kind of safety net.
Public health officials are increasingly concerned about bird flu. How could leaving the WHO affect the global coordination to prevent its spread?
First, you need to detect it. So imagine, I know right now it's in dairy cattle in the States, but it's also been detected across the world. So imagine you have samples out of Malaysia or Indonesia. Those would be used to actually work towards different diagnostics and vaccines. Would the U.S. have access to that information and to those technologies if they're moving towards that? If a country was going to respond, they share that information with WHO. What is their domestic response going to be? And that information comes out of WHO. So if the United States is not part of it, they wouldn't get that internal information of what's happening in other countries. They can get it through other channels, but obviously it's slower and more inefficient.
Devi Sridhar is professor of global public health at the University of Edinburgh and co-author of the book Governing Global Health, Who Runs the World and Why.
Football, it has long been known as America's game, but the NFL has made major efforts to expand internationally by scouting players from abroad. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on the new class of athletes coming to the U.S. to try out the gridiron.
Nathaniel Salmon grew up in a big basketball family in New Zealand. All four of his older siblings have played at a college or national level, and he himself went pro at a young age.
I've been playing professional basketball for 3 years now. I started my professional career when I was 17 and played in New Zealand and played in Australia.
at 6'7", the sport makes sense for him. But now, Salmon is setting his sights on something very different, football. And he admits he's a newbie.
American football is not big at all in New Zealand. My dad would put on like the Super Bowl sometimes just to like watch the Super Bowl because we like to have time shows, but no, we never kept up with the NFL at all growing up.
He picked up a football for the first time just 2 months ago. And yet now he's part of a group of athletes who have flown to Florida to try and make it in the NFL.
I'm always keen to learn new things and keen to give it a go.
Salmon is part of the NFL's 2025 International Player Pathway Program, or the IPP. It started in 2017 as a way for the league to bring talented athletes from other sports into the world of football. This week, 14 athletes from 13 nations start their journey.
Talent is everywhere opportunity, isn't it?
Pat Long is the Director of International Football Development at the league.
Wherever you are in the world, we will find you. And we will help you develop to your highest potential through this program.
The 10-week program includes a lot of time working out on the field and studying in the classroom.
They're learning their position. They're learning how that fits within a scheme, looking at NFL film, even college film, so that they can truly learn the ins and outs of their position. That's just as important, if not more so, than the on-field work that takes place at camp.
This year's class has athletes from Fiji, France, and Nigeria, to name a few places. They come with high-level careers in soccer, powerlifting, and track and field, like Jamaica's Roger Stona, who just won a gold medal at the Paris Olympics in the field sport, discus.
The first man from Jamaica to win a men's discus final at an Olympic Games.
Stona plans to use his strength to become a defensive line or tight end. Many athletes in the program, though, have a background in rugby, including TJ McGurn-Yunga from Zimbabwe.
Never played football, like structured, organized football, but I've thrown football in the backyard of my brothers or at school, so yeah, just for fun, like at break time.
He expects his tackling skills from rugby to transfer over nicely and says he isn't really nervous about learning a new sport. What he mostly feels now is grateful for the opportunity to be the first Zimbabwean in the IPP.
It's exciting for my family, for my friends, for the nation as a whole to have a Zimbabwean, you know, representing them in this program. And I think it's just great for other kids growing up to actually see that this isn't just something like is a dream, but it's actually attainable. And there's the pathway to it.
More than 40 IPP athletes have signed with NFL teams, proving that the pathway works. This year's class now hopes to follow in their footsteps. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World.
A seed library that started in Russia during World War II is still up and running. It survived in part because people weren't even allowed to use the seeds when they were starving.
They're quite militant about it. There's a risk, perhaps, that if we'd started eating the collection, we would never have stopped, and we just would have burned through it.
That story is still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Denmark has announced a plan this week to stop using a controversial parental competency test. The test, known as the FKU, is supposed to determine whether a parent is fit to care for a child. Rights groups have criticized the FKU for using Danish cultural norms in the test, with results punishing indigenous Greenlandic families. Denmark's social services take children away from Denmark's indigenous community at disproportionate rates. Tina Nomensen chairs a Greenlandic Inuit rights group called Sila 360. She explained to us how the parenting test works.
Actually, it's many different tests where they use the test to assess the Greenlandic parents' parenting skills. They can measure your IQ, and imagine having your IQ tested on your second language and another culture with other notions and another way of living. And there's another test called Read the Mind in the Eyes, and the parents are presented with pictures showing adult people's eyes with different mimic.
And when you say mimic, you mean basically the expression.
The expression, yes. And then the parents have to analyze the person's state of mind, if it looks angry, glad, or worried. But the mimic is also different from culture to culture, and they use the test results to assess whether or not a parent can read the child's needs.
My understanding is that there are differences in what raised eyebrows mean in Greenlandic Inuit culture compared to what raised eyebrows mean in Western culture, for example. Can you explain that?
Yes, actually. If Greenlandic people say yes, they lift their eyebrows.
So in another culture, raised eyebrows could mean nodding the head to say yes.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually made my own little experiment and took a picture of a Greenlander having lifted eyebrows saying yes. It was obvious to Greenlanders, but I sent it to some Danish friends and asked, which expression does this person have? And they all answered wrong and said, oh, the person looks scared, worried, surprised.
That's fascinating. And this test is given to non-Inuit parents as well as Inuit parents. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. It's a test that the Greenlandic parents often fail.
And I'm just wondering why that is.
I don't think we can talk about this without talking about the post-colonialistic problems that we see all over the world in former colonies. The Danish people are still suppressing the Greenlandic people. There are so much prejudice about the Greenlandic people as drunks and as abusive and, yeah, whatever.
Right. And just to point out, Greenland has been a colonial outpost of Denmark with semi-autonomous rule, correct?
Yeah, in 2009, yes, there's this self-governance.
Self-governance.
Yeah.
Tina, what prompts authorities in Denmark to administer this test? Does every parent have to take it, or is it only given in certain cases?
It's only if the Greenlandic parents refuse to have their children placed.
When you say placed, placed where?
Placed in foster care. So they actually use the test to build up their case.
So obviously there's concern for each individual family and the trauma of the separation when that happens. For the larger community, what are some of the ripple effects?
There's an impact of the children being placed. Children are taken from the parents, but it causes all the problems for them as they grow up because they lose their rights to their Greenlandic heritage. And it can cause identity crisis for the placed children.
And I gather when and if those Inuit children return home, they don't even understand sometimes the language of their birth anymore.
They don't understand. And once a parent told that they took her Greenlandic child, and when they returned the child had become Danish. And another young boy also claimed that his Greenlandic identity was stolen from him and was not able to speak to his grandparents in Greenland anymore. So it has a great impact on the children, and it has very negative consequences for them afterwards.
Mm. So this test, it's written in Danish with the correct answers, so to speak, correct, fitting Danish cultural norms. When someone from another culture and language like Inuit in Denmark are made to take this test, the results are poor. It seems kind of like an obvious problem. Why is it only being addressed now?
We have addressed it for the last 6 years, actually. 6 years. We started addressing the questions in 2019. So it also shows that it's very difficult to make changes in the practice. And even the UN Special Rapporteur on Indigenous People Rights has raised his concerns and advised Denmark to actually re-evaluate their practices when placing Greenlandic children.
Was yesterday a good news day for you, Tina?
It was. But we still have our worries because the parents do not have trust in the Danish authorities after what they have gone through.
Tina Nomensen chairs the Greenlandic Inuit Rights Group called SILA 360. She spoke to us from the Danish city of Vibor.
A new Secretary of State has been confirmed in the U.S., Marco Rubio. And today he struck an optimistic note on CBS Mornings.
I think everyone should wake up this morning and be very happy that we have elected as our 47th president a man in Donald J. Trump that wants to promote peace in the world and bring it to the end of these conflicts.
Rubio spent his first day in office with his counterparts from the Quad nations, that's India, Japan, and Australia, a group meant to counter China's influence in the Indo-Pacific, another region where the stakes are exceptionally high for the new top U.S. diplomat. Susan Glasser is well aware of the challenges ahead for Rubio. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. I started by asking her whether Rubio and Trump, former rivals, have come to share a worldview.
Look to China as the big early test of this. Marco Rubio, as a senator, was one of the leading and most prominent voices supporting a ban on TikTok that ultimately resulted in the law that was just passed. Donald Trump, as you know, was in favor of the TikTok ban before flip-flopping quite dramatically to be against it during the campaign. Rubio, in general, has been one of the most hawkish voices in the U.S. Senate on matters related to China. In fact, he actually was on a ban by the Chinese to travel to China. At the same time, Donald Trump has been very conflicting, I think, in the message that he has sent regarding China. On the one hand, he's flip-flopped on the TikTok ban, invited its CEO to his inauguration, already spoken on the phone with Xi Jinping. On the other hand, he staffed his administrations with China hawks like Marco Rubio.
What do career diplomats at the State Department expect from Rubio as a leader?
One of the concerns is that this is going to be very much driven by a much more ideological White House than Rubio himself is, and that while he may be a kind of genial person to interact with, that he will be more than willing to carry out very ideological hardline policies, impose loyalty tests on the State Department. And you already see indications that there will be large numbers of senior Foreign Service officers quitting their positions, quitting the Foreign Service outright. And in some ways, that accomplishes some of Trump's goals, too, because they can replace those people with people who they think are more ideologically in sync with them.
Last year, Rubio was among the congressional Republicans who, at Trump's urging, blocked a Ukraine aid package. What does that tell you about how we might try to negotiate an end to that conflict?
Rubio himself had long been a staunch supporter and defender of Ukraine, had voted for military assistance to Ukraine prior to the 2024 election year assistance package. And so that, to me, is an area where Trump has laid out conditions for his foreign policy that differ with the kind of foreign policy views that Rubio had before he was seeking an appointment in Donald Trump's cabinet. So that's number one. Number two, I'm not sure how public it will be. There will be a real range of opinion behind the scenes among Trump's advisors as to how best to pursue his goal of forcing Ukraine and Russia to the table. Remember that Donald Trump has made clear before that he doesn't care all that much if his aides' views differ from his own, because he's going to do whatever he wants in the end anyways. And Russia and Ukraine were a big private area of conflict among Trump's advisors in his first term as well.
One more region to get to. Susan, Rubio is the son of Cuban immigrants. Will Latin America be a significant part of his agenda?
Yeah, absolutely. This is where I think that Rubio will probably play the most influential role. Behind the scenes in the first Trump administration, in fact, Rubio was very influential already in matters dealing with the Western Hemisphere. You know, I remember some people back when I was reporting about the first Trump term calling Rubio, as a senator, the desk officer for Latin America. Although, again, if it comes to Trump's attention, then forget it, because Trump is the decider. But many, many policy issues never reach the desk of the president. And I think this is where you'll see Rubio playing a role.
We've heard President Trump say America first, and that he wants to stop existing wars and not enter new wars. Are you able to see the outlines of a Trump doctrine or approach to foreign policy emerging for this second term?
Look, Donald Trump is someone who believes in very, very muscular rhetoric around great power nationalism, you might call it. What we're seeing that's a little bit new in Trump 2.0 is this very explicit overlay of at least regional imperialism, this idea that a greater United States should be whatever he says it should be. And if that includes getting back the Panama Canal, if it includes expanding our reach into the Arctic with Greenland, if it includes pushing into Canada, you know, none of these are particularly plausible in the short term, but they speak to an aggressive vision of American nationalism as being whatever he defines it as. I saw his incoming national security advisor, Mike Waltz, as calling it an updated version of the Monroe Doctrine, which is essentially, as implemented by them, seems to mean we can do anything we want in our sphere of influence.
Susan Glasser is a staff writer at The New Yorker and is based in Washington, D.C. She's been speaking with us about what's ahead for Secretary of State Marco Rubio.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Lima, Peru is celebrating its 490th anniversary. As part of the celebrations, a bronze statue of the Spanish conquistador Francisco Pizarro was returned to central Lima on Saturday after being moved more than 20 years ago. Pizarro founded the city, but many are not happy about celebrating its colonial past. One protester described the ceremony as showing a lack of respect for the mayor of Lima.
In Spain, a single mother applied for 32 weeks of maternity leave, double the standard 16 weeks allowed. The woman argued she should get what would have been given to her and a partner if she had one. Her application was denied by social services and local courts, but after appealing the decision, a regional high court ruled in her favor.
And this from Japan, fish apparently get lonely too. An aquarium there had been closed for renovations when workers noticed the resident sunfish had stopped eating. Staff initially thought it was sick until someone suggested the fish was missing its human visitors. So they surrounded its tank with cardboard cutouts of people, and the sunfish made a full recovery.
And that is a few things you might have missed. One of the biggest and most powerful radio telescopes on Earth is located in India. It's in a quiet rural area between two cities. The quiet is key to the telescope's functionality, but it is also a symptom of a lack of development in that rural area. Now a proposed railroad crisscrossing the region brings that tension to a head. Namrata Kolachlam reports from the western state of Maharashtra.
2 hours from the city of Pune, I'm walking up to one of the antennae that make up the Giant Meter Wave Radio Telescope, or GMRT. The massive satellite dish is translucent and silvery, as tall as a 15-story building, hovering over the grasslands where leopards roam at night. This is no backyard telescope. The GMRT captures radio waves. It's the largest and most sensitive low-frequency radio telescope in the world.
We can pick up an FM station on Pluto if it was there, an airport radar on Proxima Centauri, which is the nearest star.
Divya Oberoi is one of the researchers who operate the GMRT. He takes me on a tour of the grounds, where 30 dishes are spread in a Y-shaped pattern across nearly 12 square miles. He walks me inside the building where scientists study the information captured by the antenna, and he shows me a cutting-edge supercomputer. The servers are kept cool with blasting fans. Each component of the GMRT helps scientists understand the mysteries of the universe, like how the very first galaxies were created. Yogesh Vadadkar, a scientist at GMRT, said recently his team noticed a line of stars called a tidal tail emerging from a galaxy.
Then we went and did a detailed study of it, and we realized that we've discovered the longest tidal tail known so far in the universe.
Researchers from 40 different countries rely on the GMRT for crucial information about the cosmos. And it's worked because there isn't a lot of interference from disruptive signals in this rural area. That's starting to change. In the last 30 years, more people have moved here, and that's brought new activity to their airwaves. Police and emergency communication, hospitals, FM radio stations, all that invisible traffic that comes with people. Yashwant Gupta is the director of the program overseeing the GMRT.
Anything which is high-tech emits radio waves, whether we know it or not, whether it is automobiles or it is high-tension power lines, windmills.
And now, that growth is coming to a head. A new train line has been proposed that would connect two cities on either side of the GMRT. This semi-high-speed rail project could disrupt the telescope's abilities to capture the frequencies of the universe. Amol Kole, who represents the region in Parliament, said that although the GMRT is of national importance, neighboring communities have paid a price.
Since 1996, there have been many limitations because of GMRT for the local development.
The train would open up new opportunities.
If this happens, there'll be a big help to the farmers to take their agriculture goods to different markets across the country.
In the nearby village of Kodad, a man who goes by the name Balu runs the general store. It's hard to travel from the city to the village and back, he said. The bus stands are far away. The train would help us travel faster. As negotiations have dragged on, Representative Kole proposed a provocative idea, moving the Giant Meter Wave Radio Telescope elsewhere. The Railway Ministry has already dismissed that suggestion. Going forward, GMRT Director Gupta said they're looking for a balanced solution. And the GMRT has made efforts to support the local community, including through educational programs like the town's Rural Science Center. Bernita Kare grew up in this town of Codad and said visiting the GMRT each year inspired her to become a civil engineer.
We do have a relationship with GMRT. Of course, all Codadkar have that relationship with GMRT.
It sparked her interest in science, but she's also eager for local development.
I see both sides. I studied on both sides. There is advantages too, there is a disadvantages too.
For now, the negotiations continue as all involved search for a solution. For The World, I'm Namrata Kalachalam, Codad, India.
Still ahead on the show, devastation from a fire in Turkey and a story of preservation in Russia, where a seed library survived the siege of Leningrad during World War II, and it's still going strong.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Turkey is reckoning with a deadly fire at a ski resort in the mountains southeast of Istanbul. Videos show the 12-story Grand Kartal Hotel engulfed in flames. People are yelling for help from windows. Some are climbing down using bedsheets or jumping from windows to escape.
Later in the morning, Turkey's interior minister, Ali Yerlikaya, announced that 66 people had died and 18 more were injured.
Tekrar tarifi imkansız olan bu acımızı...
Yerlikaya said the pain of the event was unspeakable and asked God's mercy for the dead.
The hotel was fully occupied with 238 guests. The fire was reported at 3:30 in the morning when most people would have been asleep. It took nearly an hour for the fire department to arrive. Some who got out of the hotel said the fire alarm didn't go off and that smoke made it hard for people to find fire escapes.
Six prosecutors have been appointed to investigate. Four people have already been detained for questioning, including the owner of the hotel.
Seed banks hold samples of genetic material from plants. They're literal vaults that preserve biodiversity. Botanists think seed banks could be one of humanity's best hopes to adapt should climate change lead to the extinction of certain plants.
But one of the world's first seed banks was created long before climate change became an existential threat. It's in St. Petersburg, Russia, and narrowly survived the Second World War. A book called The Forbidden Garden takes a look at how scientists in St. Petersburg protected the seed collection while the city spent 872 days under siege by Nazi troops. The World's Duri Buscarin has a story.
In the 1920s and 30s, Nikolai Vavilov, the father of modern plant gene banking, traveled to five continents looking for seeds. He found wild flax in Iran, edible lilies in Tokyo, rare Chilean potatoes, lemons and oranges from Afghanistan, even barley from the plateaus of Turkestan, which grows without a hull, says author Simon Parkin.
And his work is motivated by this idea that perhaps some of these wild varieties that are growing, say, high in the mountains or in very cold regions, they might have genetic qualities that could prove useful to today's farmers.
Vavilov witnessed repeated famines in the early days of the Soviet Union and became obsessed with the idea of ending hunger. And he lived his work, taking the helm of one of the first seed banks in the world, the Plant Institute in St. Petersburg, then known as Leningrad. In 1941, Nazi forces closed in around the city of Leningrad, cutting off supply routes and tightening like a vise.
The story of Leningrad's resistance matches that of Stalingrad. Its people had endured the greatest hardships.
The Nazis would besiege the city for nearly 3 years. An estimated 1.5 million people died. Despite the siege and dwindling supplies of food, the staff at the Leningrad Plant Institute made a decision. They would eat nothing from the collection, even though it contained things like potatoes, peanuts, calorie-rich specimens that could have helped them survive. In his book, The Forbidden Garden, Parkin describes the meeting.
They're quite militant about it. They're like, no, we could not have. There's a risk, perhaps, that if we'd started eating the duplicate collection, we would never have stopped and we just would have burned through it. And so I think they had to make this real black and white choice for their own sakes.
On Christmas Day in 1941, a botanist knocked on the office of his colleague, a groundnut expert, who appeared to have fallen asleep at his desk.
this packet of almonds that he had been cataloguing falls from his hands, and Shushkin has died while clutching specimens that could have extended or even spared his life, perhaps.
19 employees of the institute died during the ordeal. But in the spring, the scientists used potatoes they had saved to help build a citywide gardening campaign. Slowly, the city came back to life. And by the end of the siege, somehow, most of the seed collection had survived.
By the 1960s, 100 million acres of Russian agriculture land has been planted out with seeds derived from the institute's collections. 90% of the seeds and crops now held in St. Petersburg are found in no other scientific collection in the world.
The samples were from a unique moment in time, before large-scale industrial emissions had begun to wreak havoc on the atmosphere. But when technology like steam locomotives, airplanes, and cars could make it possible for Vavilov to collect this amount of genetic diversity in plant life. Among people who run seed banks today, this is a foundational story.
People died for that material. Well, that material is still incredibly important today.
Jeffrey Houghton is a founding director of Crop Trust, the organization responsible for operations at the Svalbard Seed Vault in Norway. You may know it as that big doomsday-looking vault built into a glacier, but it wasn't just built for the end of the world. Svalbard serves as a backup for seed banks damaged by natural disasters and modern wars. And these seed collections are crucial resources for farmers trying to breed new crops adapted to changing climates.
The challenges we face today are, if anything, one would argue, more serious for agriculture than they were in Vavilov's time. And we're going to have to rely on that material now more than ever.
In the early 1970s, Houghton helped establish a seed bank in Lebanon called Ikarda, which collected rare types of grain from all over Afghanistan, Syria, and other parts of the Middle East. When Lebanon's civil war broke out in 1975, he helped evacuate the seed collection to Aleppo.
That material was rescued. We took it out of the country along a road that had been mined, for example. And the night before we got it out, there was shelling over the building that we were staying in.
36 years later, civil war broke out in Syria.
The staff at Ikarda were working to save that material. They were under very, very difficult conditions. That material was sent to Svalbard, because by then Svalbard was operating.
These seeds became the first ones to be withdrawn from Svalbard and regrown in Morocco to replenish the original collection and preserve this diversity to feed generations ahead. For the world, I'm Dari Buscarin.
A final note today from the Australian Open Tennis Tournament, where Novak Djokovic of Serbia beat Carlos Alcaraz of Spain in a quarterfinal match. Djokovic said it was one of the most epic matches he'd ever played. The action was nonstop, stretching to nearly 1 o'clock in the morning, with one crucial point lasting 33 shots.
37-year-old Djokovic and 21-year-old Alcaraz are competitors at opposite ends of their careers. "I'm sure we're going to see a lot of him," Djokovic said of Alcaraz after the match. "Maybe not as much as I would like." Djokovic is aiming to win his 25th Grand Slam trophy.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Judy Piggott, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.